you'll excuse me for just a second, I'm going to make a quick change on PowerPoint.
Good morning. It's good to see everyone here today. It's good that we can worship our God together. So I appreciate the fact that you're here. I appreciate the fact that you've encouraged me in worship this morning. I'd like to look at the text of Mark chapter 5 this morning. So if you would go ahead and open your Bibles to Mark chapter 5. Now, I'd like to talk about a man that was changed through an encounter with Jesus Christ. And he went from a demon-possessed man, a demoniac, to a disciple. From a demoniac to a disciple. So the first thing I want to notice is that there was a man that was ravaged by the devil. Mark chapter 5. So let's read the first five verses together. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. If you want to see a picture of a pitiful individual, this is one. He was ravaged by the devil, and this is the result. This man was demon-possessed, not just by one demon, as we'll learn later, but by a legion or a host or many demons. And so it's almost as if the full brunt of the devil's force came against this man. So it's just five verses, but if we just almost go line by line, you can see how time and time again this man was ravaged by the devil. First of all, we see that he had an unclean spirit. That was the reason for the fact that he was ravaged. He had an unclean spirit, it says there in verse 2. We go on to see that this man was living among the tombs. That was his home. I know some people here have bought homes recently. You look for, you know, two or three bedrooms. Make sure you have room for the kids. Make sure you have a nice house, good neighborhood. You know, I can only imagine the asking price for the home here. You know, what is it they say? I need to check with Gene. Location, 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 right? This man lived among the tombs. He lived in a place of death, where death resided. Where death dwelled. And that was his home. We also see that he was one that lived alone. When we talk about a neighborhood, he didn't have a lot of other people that were living with him. His only companions were those that had already died. And so this man was ravaged, tortured by the demons that were within him. And you can see the outcome of that in his person. We also see that the text says that he could not be tamed. In verse 3 it says he lived among the tombs and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had strength to subdue him. This man had tremendous amount of strength, the supernatural strength that came from these demons. No individual could subdue him. One commentator noted that this word actually has the connotation of a taming. So I don't know about you, but that seems unusual to talk about what you would do with another human being. The point is, this man was acting like an animal, wasn't he? And he's treated like an animal. And the text says that no one could even tame this individual. He was not civilized for sure. This man was out of his mind, acting in a way following after the demon possession. He could not be contained. He could not be subdued. There was no one that could come and put him in order, so to speak. And so we see this man ravaged by the devil. We see that he was destructive to others. Other people tried to control him and bind him with chains and various things like that, with cords, but they couldn't do it. And so we see that whenever people came around, that he would persecute them. He would trouble them. He was destructive to other people.
And so we see that often he was avoided, and that led to him further being alone.
You'll notice in verse 5, it says, "Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones." This individual was full of pain and sorrow. It's a sad phrase, the first three words there of verse 5. It says, "Night and day." Night and day. I don't know if you've ever experienced some kind of sickness, or you've experienced the loss of a loved one. You've experienced some kind of difficulty. They say that time heals those wounds, and often life is something where, as it moves on, we're able to cope and to deal with those things. But it's a sad situation to see somebody that is suffering continually. And that's what this man is doing. The text says that it was night and day. Night and day, he was not saying, "I feel a little bit bad." It says that he was crying out. The idea is that his pain was audible and you could hear it. This man was crying out. Part of the reason he was crying out and part of the reason that he was in pain is because he was self-destructive. He was actually taking stones, the text says. And he was cutting himself. This man was self-destructive. Again, this is a sad picture, isn't it? To realize that a human being could act in this way. As you go down the list, every time you check off something else that describes this individual, it's simply sad. This man was ravaged by the devil. We also see that he was tormented by God, and we see that as we move in to verse 6. And we'll notice there in verse 6 and following, but this man was ravaged by God, ravaged by God. Let me just take a few moments to reflect upon this list as well. I don't know if you see where I'm going with this, but what Satan did to this man physically, that's the same thing that he accomplishes spiritually through temptation and sin. This man suffered the effects of having a demon in him, but today Satan has not stopped his handiwork. Satan has not rested. He's not one to rest on his laurels. He doesn't give up, does he? He keeps attacking. He keeps fighting. The devil's not just a fictitious individual with a tail and a pitchfork that we talk about 2,000 years ago. The devil is active today, seeking to destroy, seeking to ravage people. And I believe that he is ravaging people today. There is no clearer picture in all of Scripture of the hazardous effects of what happened when Satan takes resident in a person's heart. That's this list right here. But the difference is, with sin and the ravaging of our soul and our hearts, it's often not as visible clearly as what we see here. And so often it's minimized, or it's ignored, or it's said, "This isn't a problem. This is something I can control." You know, we don't have demon possession today, but it does remind me of the way that drugs can ravage an individual. On the internet, I looked at a website that was for a rehab facility. And it showed pictures of those that have been affected by methamphetamine use. And I just want to read some of this. You know, I debated on putting the pictures, they have pictures side by side of those before and after use, and I didn't do it. But I would like to describe this for you. And just even within a year or two, the skin. Acne appears or worsens. Excessive skin picking often causes meth users' faces to be covered in small sores and scarring, the result of a common sensory hallucination of bugs crawling beneath the skin. The facial musculature and fat Meth, like other stimulants, suppresses appetite and can lead to undernourishment due to long periods without eating. Over time, the body begins consuming muscle tissue and facial fat, giving users a gaunt, hollowed-out appearance. Teeth and gums. Meth mouth is caused by several factors. Tooth enamel is dissolved by the harsh chemicals of the drug. The blood vessels contained in healthy gums and teeth shrink, increasing the rate of decay. The production of saliva diminishes, allowing harmful acids to further damage the mouth. Cravings for sugary foods increases with meth use. Oral hygiene is typically neglected while high, and heavy tooth grinding is an additional side effect of the drug. We also see that, and this is probably the best description here, there is an increased estimated age. The combination of skin issues, facial fat, and muscle loss, hygiene neglect, and increased oral decay lead to the appearance of exaggerated aging, sometimes shockingly so. They showed pictures of 23-year-olds that looked like a vibrant, healthy young man, and a 25-year-old that had been ravaged by drug use that looked like a 45-year-old. Their face was shrunken in. They had malnutrition. You see that their teeth were all messed up. They had scabs all over. Their eyes were sunken in. And I think that's what stood out most to me as I saw that picture, is the eyes. They say that the eyes are the window of the soul, and I believe that. In our house, we've had a little bit of sickness lately with some colds, and especially with Ezra and Clara, you can just see it in their eyes. They're not feeling well, right? They feel sick. Well, when I looked at the eyes of this vibrant young 23-year-old, full of life, and then I saw the eyes of the 25-year-old that had been ravaged by drugs, there was a hollow, glassy look, an empty shell. Truly, this individual had been ravaged by sin. Well, why am I even talking about drugs? I'm talking about those things because I think those are physical things we can see in a way that something that is harmful, that is taken into the body, can ravage that individual. And I'm trying to show these physical things because we don't see the physical aspects always when we're talking about sin. But that is the same thing that happens when we allow Satan into our heart. We are this demon-possessed man if we allow sin to reign. We are those meth users of the soul when we allow Satan to reign. We can be ravaged by the devil today just as much. Just as much. You know, if I were to go through this list again, think about this in spiritual terms. An unclean spirit. Unclean. Allowing a spirit, allowing Satan into your heart. That which is healthy is transformed into sickness. Innocence changes to shame and guilt. A pure heart blackens and grows worse and worse as sin allows to have its ugly effect. The unclean spirit is when Satan enters into the heart. What about this individual that lived among the tombs? Those that imbibe sin and live in sin without God surely are on a pathway and invite death into their life. In Romans 6 and verse 23, it says, "For the wages of sin is death." This demoniac lived alone. And did you know that's exactly what sin does to us? Sin isolates us from others. In Isaiah 59, it shows us the greatest isolation is our isolation from God. "But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. And your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear." In the garden, Adam and Eve ran and hid when they had imbibed sin. And so it is with sin. Sin isolates us, separates us from other people, and most importantly from God. This individual lived alone. The text says that no one could tame him. He could not be subdued. You know, Satan is not a cute, cuddly kitten. You know, sometimes we have that picture with the pitchfork, you know, a little red tail and just this cute little picture. He's not a cute, cuddly kitten, but a ravenous lion seeking someone to devour. Satan is not man's best friend, but man's most destructive foe. Sin cannot be tamed or controlled. But yet that's one of the greatest lies that we tell ourselves. This sin is not that big a deal. This sin is not that big a problem. You know, I have control over this. I can stop if I want to. I'm just doing it a little bit. I'm just getting close to the line. And we lie and we lie and we lie to ourselves. We say that sin's not a problem. The truth is, sin controls us. It cannot be tamed. You do not have control over it if you continue in it. If you push it away, that's the best control you can have. But you can't invite it into your house and think that you can control it. Sin is something that cannot be tamed. We also see that this man was destructive to others, and so it is with sin. Sin harms not only the one committing it, but also other people. Do I even need to expound upon this point? As I go through murders, drunk driving, the effects of adultery, the effects of lying, of embezzlement, list every one of those. It hurts other people. One of the questions that people try to raise against God is, why is there evil in the world? There is evil in the world in large part because people choose sin. And it has a destructive effect. A destructive effect. This demoniac was full of pain. Pain and sorrow. You know, sin promises fun times. The ideal lifestyle. Living it up. But whatever good times there are, Hebrews chapter 12 11 describes those as fleeting pleasures of sin. Sin promises a lot but delivers very little. So you may have a good time for just a very short time, but the lasting effects on the heart are that of a soul that is ravaged by sin. And pain and sorrow will be the lasting effect. And that's just here. That's just here. We talk about the next life, pain and sorrow will continue amplified. We see that this demoniac, the demon-possessed man, was self-destructive. He took stones and cut himself, and we shake our heads. How could anybody do something like that that would hurt themselves, that would destroy themselves? Something is not right if you're going to act in that way. Yet that is exactly what we do when we take up residence with sin and allow Satan into our heart. When we live according to that way and that fashion, we're carrying out things that are self-destructive, that are hurting our own selves. And it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. Finally, we see that this man was tormented by God, and we'll see that particularly in the next section. And that's exactly the way the sinner reacts to God. The sinner is tormented by God, his holiness, and his demand to change. The conscience of the sinner feels the pain of remorse until he continues on and his conscience is hardened and calloused and he no longer responds. See, the sinner cannot live in such a way where he continues his actions and yet deals with God. He's either going to push God away or push his sin away. For man cannot serve two masters. It's a sad picture, isn't it? That's as low as it gets. But that's the picture of sin. That's the picture of sin in all its gory details, in all its blackness. It turns your stomach, creates a sense of disgust, and it should, because that's the devil's handiwork. We see furthermore, though, that this man did not stay this way. And that's one of the reasons I love this account, or love this story here. This man was rescued by Jesus Christ. Verses 6 through 13. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs were feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. When we see that Jesus rescued this man, it really fits in with the picture of Mark. The fundamental question in the book of Mark is, who is Jesus Christ? The book starts with a proclamation that Jesus is the Christ, but as you continue on throughout the book, it's almost like it starts from scratch. We know the end of the story. We profess who that is, but if you're reading through Mark, there seems to be a question. And the book shows us little by little, with each episode, a fuller picture of who Jesus Christ is. In chapter 2 and verse 12, when the paralytic was healed, the people exclaimed, "We've never seen anything like this." When the people saw Jesus and what he did, it was something that had not been seen. Jesus challenged the hypocrisy of the Pharisees in chapter 2 and verse 28, and he was declared to be the Lord of the Sabbath as he took on the religious leaders. In chapter 3 and verse 21, his family questioned him and said, "He is out of his mind." And so their question, who is this Jesus, this amazing individual, or maybe he's just a lunatic? He's something that someone that people have not seen before. In chapter 4 and verse 41, Jesus commanded the storm to still. And it did. Nature obeyed this individual. And his disciples said, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" It's after he gets out of the boat, after stilling the storm, that we see chapter 5. And so this is another step along the way as we ask the question, who is this man? Who is Jesus Christ? Well, I believe we see some answers to that in this account. So we see that Jesus is different than others. He's not like other people. We've seen that all along, and we continue to see that in this account as well. We see, first of all, with his power. You know, other people tried to subdue this man. They even tried to use chains to subdue this man. The whole town, took an effort at this. And yet they couldn't. They couldn't subdue him. They didn't have the power to do that. But we see that Jesus, he doesn't avoid the place or treat it like it's the plague or this is Satan's domain. This is the place where I shouldn't go. He goes straight to the land of the Gerasenes, to the land of this demoniac. And we see that he's going to have power to do something about it. We also see when it comes to fear. Did you notice that all the people of the town feared this demon-possessed man? They didn't want to be around him. They didn't want to come close to him. In fact, the best thing to do is stay away. I can hear parents now telling their children, on your way home from school, don't go by this road. You stay away from there. It's dangerous taking their children aside. And it was commonly known, don't go down this road. Don't go by this man because it's a dangerous thing. And all the people feared. But how does the demon-possessed man and the demons react to Jesus? Was Jesus afraid? There's no hint of fear in Jesus. But on the other hand, we see that the demons are very afraid of Jesus Christ. As they approach him, they holler out and say, What do you have to do with us? You're not going to send us out, are you? Please don't send us out. They have fear of him. There's also a recognition of who he is. There are many people in Mark that do not confess and profess that Jesus is the Christ. But you can't list the devil as one of those. The devil does not deny that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. In fact, he confesses it. "What have you to do with me?" he says in verse 7. "Jesus, Son of the Most High God." He recognized who he was. And with that, he recognized his power and his authority in these things. We also see that Jesus had authority. You know, the demon-possessed man kind of exercised a tyrannical rule. He had authority, in a sense, through might and terror. But when it comes to Jesus Christ, we see that the demon recognized his authority. The demon says, "Do not send me, and may I go into the swine." You see, the demons recognized who Jesus was. They recognized his authority and his power, his right to command. We also see that the results are quite different. The results of what the demons did to this man, we've already looked at. He was ravaged by the demons. But what Jesus is going to do is going to be quite different. And we're going to see that in the next section. But let me just point out one other thing. Well, I guess I didn't add it. And that is, notice that the demons beg. I just want you to notice that the demons beg. "Please don't send us away." And that says in verse 12 again, they begged him, "Send us into the pigs." So they ravage this man, and then they even go on to destroy the host of pigs. The unclean spirit kills the unclean animals to the Jews. Well, after this, we see that there's going to be reaction to Jesus. And Jesus is rejected by those in the town. First of all, the people witnessed what he had done. Notice how it says that they had witnessed that. Let's read verses 14 through 17. "The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region." What Jesus had done was witnessed. People saw this. The herdsmen saw, first of all, what had happened with the swine, but also the people came and saw the man that was demon-possessed, the one where they whispered in their houses to their children, "Don't walk by this way. Avoid this man at all costs." They see him now as a different individual entirely. He's sitting there clothed and in his right mind. So they witness this, but notice how they respond. The text says that they responded with fear. They responded with fear. This is actually the way that the disciples respond when Jesus stilled the storm. It says, "And they were afraid and said, 'Who is this man that can calm the storm?'" The disciples were afraid of this immense amount of power. Now, we're not told exactly why the people were afraid. We might surmise that they were afraid of this man, this demon-possessed man, that had a tremendous amount of power. And now they see another individual that has even more power than that. So maybe just on that basis, they were afraid. They were afraid. And so they beg, just as the demons beg Jesus. Now the townspeople are begging him to go away. They're begging him to leave. Really, their biggest failure is not that they recognize the difference in power, because certainly Jesus had more power, but they never stopped to ask the question, is Jesus good? You know, most of what we know, when people have power, it corrupts. They say that absolute power corrupts absolutely. When people get power, they often use it to their own benefit, even if it harms other people. And so people are afraid of power, but what is so striking and different about Jesus Christ is that he had power. He had tremendous amount of power, power as God. But we see that he was good. And the people should have been able to see that too. Jesus didn't create a more dangerous individual that was more scary to them. The text says that he was there in a different place, a different situation, and the townspeople didn't have to fear him anymore. So they didn't consider his goodness. They instead were afraid and they begged him to depart. They rejected him and they didn't want any part of him. Notice that they enjoyed the blessings that he brought, and he did bring blessings by removing this demon-possessed man from terrorizing them. They enjoyed his blessings, but they turned away from him and wanted him to leave their presence. And that's a sad commentary, isn't it? Because we see the same thing happening today. As people see and experience the blessings of the Lord in many ways, but yet they turn away from those blessings. And they simply ask Jesus to depart. Leave me alone. We don't want anything to do with you. Well, we also see in verses 18 through 20 that this demon-possessed man responded in quite a different way. He was received by this healed man. In verse 15, it describes him as one that was clothed and in his right mind. And then in verses 18 through 20, it says, as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So as I mentioned, we see that this man had experienced the goodness of the Lord. He was clothed and in his right mind. Let me just take a quick aside to say, this man was clothed and in his right mind. Clothes and your right mind go together. If you're going to take your clothes off, it doesn't show a very good state of mind. In the Bible, poverty, those that were poor and didn't have clothes, that was a sign. It was not something they just did to enjoy summer sports or something like that. Okay, that's my aside. As we look at this man, he was clothed and in his right mind. What a picture. What a different picture. I talked about the meth user before and after. Put this individual as a before and after picture. Before, as he was ravaged. You know, it says he was clothed. I can only imagine that this lunatic, this man that was demon-possessed, had shredded clothes. You know, as he took stones to himself. If he even had clothes on at all. And so we see that the different picture is a man that was clothed, sitting there in his right mind. He certainly experienced the goodness of the Lord. Jesus restored to this man decency, self-respect, and a recognition of the very power of God. Recognized that one is greater than himself. This man went from misery, to be able to enjoy the blessings of God. It was peace for him to be able to sit there in his right mind. Before, night and day, he was crying out, moaning in pain. But now he could sit there in his right mind. Well, how does he respond to that? He begs. We see that the demons beg. We see that the townspeople beg. And now we see this man begging. And how does he beg? He begs to be with Jesus. He begs to be with the Lord. If this is what God brings me, then I want to be with God with all my might. I can see the change that is there. Jesus asks him, and he says that he does not permit him. But notice what he tells him to do in verse 19. Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Go and tell. That statement is the highlight of this text. That's what Jesus wanted this man to tell, and that's what the scriptures want us to see about this man, Jesus Christ. Jesus is one that can do great things by the very hand of God. Jesus Christ is one that is merciful, can bring one that is in pain and sorrow to comfort and peace. One that can bring one ravaged by the devil, can send him out and bring forgiveness and release. Jesus Christ is an individual of pure mercy, of pure love, and pure kindness. And he's reaching out to you and to me. The one that is all-powerful, we might want to be afraid of someone that's all-powerful, but Jesus is not only all-powerful, but all-good. And he wants what is good for you and for me. And so he did a few things. He acknowledged God in this. You know, it's not that God has hand-selected a few people to bless and said, you know, you this corner, okay, I'm going to bless you and tough luck for everybody else. No, the blessings are available for all people, from physical blessings to spiritual blessings, available for all people. The difference is whether you will acknowledge it or not. And Jesus tells this man to go and acknowledge. See how great things and how great God has been to me. God has been great to all of us, but not all of us recognize it or focus upon it. And so he tells him to acknowledge God. He tells him then to talk about his feelings of experiencing the mercy of God. Go and tell how much the Lord has done for you and how He has had mercy on you. As Christians, that's something we can do. We can tell other people about how God has done great things for us and how God has had mercy on us. Now, I'm not saying that this is a testimonial as if we all have our unique pathway to Christ. And so here's mine, and maybe you could do mine, and everybody has their own way. I'm not saying that. But we can speak to how God has experienced, or how we have experienced God's grace and mercy. It's something that we can know about. It should be bubbling and flowing from our hearts. There should be a great amount of appreciation. And if we're going to talk to other people, we need to tell them this is the goodness that is available. I know about it because I've experienced it. This is not a cold sell. Would you buy some of this cream? I don't use this, but I need you to buy this many cases. You know, this is not a cold sell. This is one deeply personal to us. And we can tell people, this is the great things God has done for me, and this is how He has mercy on me. I was ravaged by sin, seeking my own way. And yet God has saved me, sending His Son to die on the cross for the forgiveness of my sins. We also see the need of telling others. Of telling others. It's not only that he acknowledged God's blessing, and he had experienced the goodness of the Lord, but then he went and told other people about that. And that's exactly what we need to do. If you will bear with me one second here, I'm going to bring up Mark's song. We're going to be singing an invitation song in just a second. Grace greater than our sin. I have a few questions for you. Are you willing to cling to your sin and hold your sin so tightly despite its ravaging effects? Or would you rather come before Jesus, be clothed and in your right mind? It seems like an obvious answer, doesn't it? The benefits far outweigh the price. So, would you acknowledge God and His blessings? Would you taste and see that the Lord is good? Let me just say that the alternative is a very scary proposition. To have life without God, described in Ephesians chapter 2, is a life without hope. As Israel was, or the Gentiles were without hope as they were away from God. That's the life that we're describing. Are there those here today that are not Christians that want to answer the call to become a Christian, to devote your life to God? I believe that you would respond to that with a great deal of rejoicing. And even though you'll suffer difficulties and persecution, it will be so worth it. If you're a Christian and you're here today, you've committed your life each and every day to His service. And if you're not fulfilling that commitment, then you need to change your ways and change your life. Jesus Christ has blessed us so greatly, and He is certainly worth it. So what is your decision? What are you going to do with your life today? Please come as we stand and sing at this time.
Marvelous grace of our God, Lord.